Welcome to the August 2026 episode 10 of Reverend Dr. Robert Flanagan's Courage to Thrive show. Today is a really interesting conversation. We're going to talk about the power of being a lifelong friend. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, proud producer of the show. So happy to welcome Andrew Cregan. He's a financial advisor who has been practicing for 30 years. He and his wife, Kathy, have raised 5 kids, and he says our home in Williamsburg is big enough for them all to stay anytime. Andrew is an avid golfer who loves to kayak and travel. And today we're going to learn so much about this lifelong friendship that these two gentlemen have had. Take it away, Bob.
All right. Well, welcome, Andrew. Welcome to Courage to Thrive. So great to have you with us. How you been, buddy?
Well, I'm telling you, it's been one of those days. So
yeah. Is that because you didn't go to Taco Bell, did you?
No.
No, and God bless those people who have who went to Taco Bell and had the lettuce. I
yes,
prayers are for it, you know, with them. But you know, before we get too far, it could not be more cliche, could it, that the origin of all these problems that everyone is having in the country this July is Taco Bell. I mean, I feel kind of bad for the company. You know, I certainly feel bad about it for the employees, but that's just, it's so cliche that this would be the place of all the places that would have a problem. So, well, all right. So how has your summer been? How you been? We haven't talked in that recently. So
summer's been good. It's been crazy busy, which is nice. I've been away. I was up out in Coronado for July 4th, which was great.
Did you get any golfing in?
As a matter of fact, I did.
Yes, and everybody understands that's the devil's game, in my opinion. the golf and I do not relate well. We will leave that the stories behind, but that you.
Oh, I'm glad to tell them.
I know, aren't you? But me getting almost thrown off a golf course. Golf is not, is a long walk spoiled on my end, not on yours though. So you were out in Coronado enjoying golf, enjoying the weather.
And being very patriotic, Coronado is one hell of a place to, see the parade, see the fireworks, see the parachuters and all the rest of it. So
right.
Good day.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. Anything for August? I mean, since we're going to air this in August, what do you have going?
Well, good. You can all do it in August when we're in Paris.
Ah, see there. He'll be out of the country. He can deny ever knowing that this was going to happen. Yeah, that's good.
Exactly.
So,
yes.
Why Paris and what are we going to see?
Okay, so it's Kathy and I. We went to Spain last year, did Barcelona and Madrid. That's right. Decided to do Paris this year and also see Normandy and Giverny, which is where the paintings were done.
Nice.
And so 9 days, it's all good.
Yeah,
and basically, Kathy wants to make sure she gets to have a good time visiting places that she wouldn't see otherwise while she can before I get too old.
There you go. There you go. Well, that is the challenge of marrying a young and being with a younger woman. You know,
yes,
as we know.
It's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's all good.
So, yeah. She wants to get in all her trips. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Right,
speaking of trips, I've got a trip coming up as you know. I am going to be heading over to England myself in the beginning.
Well, how
very
about
beginning
that?
of August. So, and among other things that I'm going to be doing is attending my son's wedding. You know, this will be the first of my children getting married, and obviously the first time I am father of the groom. Yeah.
Yes.
And so, and you have, you also have a similar father of the groom coming up as well, don't you?
Yes, in October, my son's getting married.
All right. So, all right.
That should be fun.
And we had touched base beforehand, so just to let everybody know, we are going to talk about the travails, the and joys of marrying off a son. Not so much, you know. Not, what I'm really interested in, and this is so fun for me, is that I get to do, that I get to be a part of a wedding. You know, as a priest, I've done a lot of weddings, right? And I have a hundred of these things I've done over the years. But this is a time where I get to be, you know, on the other side of all of this, for better or for worse, mind you. this could go sideways. And what is interesting is some of the things that I've learned about as the officiant of a wedding, as the person who's going to preside over a marriage ceremony, is I've had, and now being on the other side and living out those things. So I thought it'd be fun for us to talk about, and maybe, well, it'll be fun for us to talk about, whether I hope others enjoy listening to us, but the what it's like to be a father of the groom, and how it might be different than anything else, any other positions in all of this. But then also, for my situation, my son and his fiance are getting married over in England, and lo and behold, what I understand is it's similar to this. It's cheaper actually to travel to Japan and go to Disney in Japan than it is to go to Disney, to Disneyland, or possibly Disney World, and in the U.S. So for whatever reason, just the expenses are. So similarly, it is less expensive for those paying for this ceremony to do it in the U.K., than it is here in the U.S. And partly that's because of numbers, and partly that's just because it's less expensive. So we've got that. But okay, so I want to spend some time talking about what advice we might give our sons, and then also what advice we might give to everybody else that's listening that might be in our shoes. At someday soon, being the father of the groom. Why don't we start with that whole father of the groom thing? Because I know I'm ahead of you, because you know I'm T minus like 3 weeks before this whole thing's going down. So I can tell you from my end that there's a lot of I just don't care.
from the groom or from you?
From the father of the groom.
There you go.
You know, it's yep. Like, what kind of cake is? I don't care. You know, what I actually, and this is a sad state. Probably the one thing I care about is when we're all finishing, because it's going to cut into my sleeping time. So how about, so what have you thought about this far out? I mean, I can go on for a while, but this far out, what are you thinking? What's your experience so far as father of the groom?
Well, it's very interesting. Both sides, both my son and his fiance, have divorced parents. So, fortunately, squares have four corners, and I'm assuming, from what I've been told, that each one will have their own corner to stay in or move about if they want to.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that is a challenge these days, right? So yes. We only have half of our of the parents are in that situation, and so it's not quite the same. So it's my wife and I, and then And then the bride's parents are divorced, and so it's navigating that. But I have found that, in comparison to the mothers of the bride and the mothers of the mother of the groom, that my investment in all of this is a lot less. There's just not, I just can't get worked up about this at all. I mean, listen, she's a lovely woman, and I'm really happy that my son is marrying her. But what happens the day of? Either I'm going to be like I guess my goal here, and perhaps your goal, maybe you agree with it, maybe you disagree, is I don't want to be a problem that day.
Yes, very much so. About anything.
Yeah, about anything. So how do you, would you like another drink? Sure.
Yes.
Would you do you would you like to park us to park the car or whatever? Yeah, that'd be nice. Thank you. Do you is it we would like it to be black tie? Okay. Sure. Okay. Not that I, care one way or the other, but or
Well,
rather, yeah.
it's even just it's kind of like if you have kids that have a less attractive offspring, you just say, "What a beautiful baby."
Of course you do. And I think you actually buy into that. Right? I mean, I
Yes.
think to be honest, I think that there's, I mean, we've experienced a new addition to our family, extended family. And the first this little guy is going to be 1 year pretty soon. And the first few weeks there, everybody was just oohing and aahing and how beautiful this kid was. He was okay. You have to have average, and I think he was average. I mean, he's a lovely, cute little guy. Is he the most cutest little thing I've ever seen? No, I think you're right. But was I really gonna step into that one and say,
No.
no, boy, that guy's got a big head? No, it's fine. I have a big head too. It's a problem with being Irish.
It's true. It really is. So that's the thing is keeping your P's and Q's is just something where you just know you don't cause any trouble no matter what.
Right. I, as all the weddings I've done, I remember the mothers of the bride. I don't recall anybody else. I think that's the goal, is that you just don't want to be remarkable. You don't want
Yes.
you there's no re you just want to be that person in the photo, right, with the
Yes,
smile on the
exactly.
face. You
Yes.
want to be the person who's just having a good time, but not too good of a time, and not too, and never complain. I think you're right. You don't complain.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
You leave that to some uncle.
I like it.
So we got, so, all right. So it's not to be the background, but you have to, I mean, like, so here's one of my challenges. Maybe you can help me out. Let me think this through. Is one of the things we have to do as fathers of the groom, or one of the expectations that I have to with this is at the rehearsal dinner, the whatever, the night before, I'm hosting that dinner. So I'm expected, these days my wife will say some words too. But I tell you, Andrew, you know, what do you say? You know, what do you, you know, there you are, you get up in front of everybody and you've got the four corners to deal with, right? So how do you navigate this? I mean, I think that's a real challenge. I had not thought about that. I had not thought about this one bit. And I'm like, oh, what do I say? So, I mean, you again, you've got some time. It's not till October. So have you put any thought onto this? Maybe you haven't. And maybe I'm making you panic now.
Well, no, but I'm hoping that I can watch the video before from yours. So I know exactly what not to do.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I everybody's worried about AI. I mean, this is one of those things. I mean, I know I like to write, but I tell you, AI in this case, I asked AI, I asked one of the AI generators. I'm like, give me 200 words on what the groom's father is supposed to say before the wedding, you know, before the night before the wedding. And it came back and it did an okay job. Now it was, you know, you say nice things about everybody who's there. Thank you all for coming. You're wonderful people. I got that. Okay. That made a lot of sense. You say nice things about your kid, you know, your son, and you say a lot of nice things about, you know, his bride to be at that point. Yes. Still. And then you gracefully get out, you know, and basically
that's exactly
show
it.
Yeah.
That so, can be done in 2 minutes.
Yeah. I tell you, I think that's right. You know, and say, everybody please eat and drink some more. So I think that's the overall goal that I got out of the, AI programs. But I'm also thinking very tempting to ask AI to write the whole thing for me in either A, in the version of Game of Thrones, right? Or B, a version of maybe Frodo might say at a Hobbit wedding, you know?
See, you're crossing the line there.
They're a little risky. Yeah. Okay. Okay. But I think I know for sure that there's some groomsmen that would think it's epic if I did that. However, see rule A, do not make yourself memorable. So I don't think I can do that. Although I would have some groomsmen just going, yes, Frodo lives. Bilbo Baggins, this is it. You know. So that's okay. So first, to be serious for a moment, what would we I tell you, my son has actually asked me this, so maybe I was like, wow, I was a little taken aback because I hadn't thought about it. He said, so Dad, you know, what advice would you, you know, what advice would you give me? And I was like, okay, at that moment I hadn't thought about it, but it's been a few weeks now. So, so maybe we can come up with like two or three things that we could say. So why don't you start us off? What would your advice be?
Funny enough, I got asked this question by a coworker who's about to get married.
Really? Okay.
And for some reason looked up to me and said, you know, what can you suggest? And I said, I'm wrong. I'm sorry. I did it. It's my fault. And I'm sorry. and if you do that, then it's all good. And he looked at me almost like, oh my God. but the funny part is there's some real truth to that.
Yeah.
If you can learn how to do that humbly.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Of course you don't want to say, well, I'm wrong. You know, again, yeah, I could see that. Yeah. So, all right. All right. All right. There's that sense of like being willing to be humble, right? It sounds like.
Yes.
To not be stubborn, to...
No. You can be stubborn.
I'm Irish. Can be stubborn. Okay. But you just have to be wrong in your stubbornness.
Yes.
Okay. And apologize often about being so stubborn. Got it. Okay. Yeah, I can see what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So we've got, all right. So I would agree, you know, I would agree with that. That's always a good starting point, right? You know, to say, not to sit there and say I'm right about this and get into a back and forth argument. That neither is, you know, you're going to win. It's better we had a boss when you and I worked together would say, fall on your sword, which is an awful way of saying I'm sorry. But he was referring to the old, samurai warriors that would, you know, kind of kill themselves by falling on their sword. And I don't think we want to fall on our sword that way, but to be humble or to be willing to say I was wrong is, I think, was he was referring to.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt.
Yeah. So, okay. So I heard this lately. I thought this had some merit. Is somebody said marriage is not about 50-50. It's not about 50-50, but it's about being 100 times 2, meaning it's 100%, 100% on both. But I'd also say is not every day anybody has 100% to give. And that's the what I found in my 37 years of marriage is, you know, there are days that my 100% is 10%. You know, it's just, I'm not feeling well, or I'm, you know, didn't sleep well the night before. I got a lot of some other stuff on my mind. Maybe my 100% equals 10%. And hopefully my wife's 100% equals 90%, right? But if we're both at 10%, then there's a lot of I'm sorry is going around, right? I get that. So, all right. So yeah, the 100% thing sounds good, except, you know, you get a pet that dies, a parent that dies, a kid that's sick, the bills back up, you know, there's a lot of reasons why your 100% isn't 100%. Yeah. Okay. So what about, I used to preach, you know, I used to give these messages, about marriage to couples when I officiate or lead a service. And it would say, I would say the things that, you know, you can build a life on kindness and respect, right? That you could really, you could live, you know, you can live with somebody. And part of the reason I guess I would say that, part of it, I didn't say on love, because I'd always argued that love is this emotion that comes and goes. And there are some days you wake up and you're not loving. And so how am I supposed to carry on, you know? And then there are days that she's not, you know, feels loving. And how do I deal with that? But if I always have, if I'm always kind and I always respect my spouse, then that works pretty well, I think. Then I saw these two people. I was leading a church, and I would watch every Sunday these two people. They had been married for, I don't know, 60, maybe 70 years, right? And it was a big church with a long center aisle, and they would come down it, and they'd have the aides would be around. And the two of them kind of would, one would put their hand on the railing, you know, the pews, and the other one would be holding, you know, kind of, they'd be arm in arm on the other side as they walked down the aisle. And lo, you know, they'd sit all the way up front. So, you know, they have to walk down 60 pews. I was like, good God, but okay. But they were determined to sit up front. And so they would sit there and they'd hold each other's hands and be, you know, care for each other during this service. And behind them were the aides. And I thought, well, that's how, you know, how, why, all that stuff. And I would think, you know, love is this fleeting emotion, but I'd look at them and I'd say, well, they have love. It's more than kindness and respect. It's love for each other, that love for their companion, which I thought, you know, it can be love. You can have that, that part of one that can be part of what's going on. So I thought, you know, I think that there's a deeper love that can be there that is found through loss and joy that, you know, some people get to have that, you know, in their lives. So I think I'm still at the I'm sorry stage, though.
Well, you know, it's funny, as both of us know from losing parents, when the person dies, there's usually at least something more that you would have wanted to say, or something that you'd like to relive, maybe right, in a different way.
Right.
And so you come to realize how fleeting everything is, and to just enjoy what you have, knowing that sooner or later it's going to be gone.
Right.
And, you know, much to the same thing, I was thinking about an argument I had at some point not too long ago. And she went off storming, you know, and without it being concluded. And so what am I going to do? Leave? You know, we share the house. So I stayed where I was, and a little later on, she came down and said, you know, I'm sorry, I just blew off the handle. And the thing about that was the steadiness of just saying, you know, we're not going anywhere, you know,
right,
we're going to stay together.
Right.
Don't bring it all to the edges, because that's where it gets difficult.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not going anywhere. So we're going to work this out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think that's great advice. I think that is great advice. So, all right. So, you've had, we're going to turn away from this whole wedding thing. I think we've got some good advice. Anybody else is going to be the groom, the father of the groom. I think there's no magic pill. You know, you take the one that this isn't the Matrix. But I think we've settled that, you know what, there's only downside to the father or the groom, right? You can only mess this up, right? And so the best thing is to not do that. Just
how about that?
Be low key. It's not about you.
Yes, exactly.
But so I, you know, as long as I've known you, and we've known each other for 30 plus
30 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've known that you've during that time, you were been involved with Alcoholics Anonymous and AA. And I was hoping that you would kind of spend some time talking about that. I don't think it's something that people, you know, I think it's that I don't think there are people, a lot of people who will talk about it, but understandably so. But I think I think there's a lot of curiosity around, you know, around it, and understanding that being an Episcopal priest, that most of our churches have AA meetings, and I think where the congregations have the most problem with alcohol, we have the most number of AA meetings that one could have in a day. Sometimes there's five or six a day. And I think, okay, here's a town that's supposed to be wildly, you know, put together and successful, and we have these, you know, enormous number of AA meetings to go with it. So I'm thinks it's okay to drink alcohol, but also has a long history of being involved with AA. So would you mind telling me your story about that? And
sure,
I'll
give you the Reader's Digest version. I'm at a Jets Giants game, the old Meadowlands, with all my buddies from high school who drink heavily, as I did at the time. And knowing that we're going down into a cold weather stadium, you start drinking on the way down, and then you drink while you're waiting for the coals to get hot so that you can make your hamburgers and all. And so you continue to drink. And then when you go in, you have some more. And there was a person that was at the game that somebody had told me he stopped drinking 5 years ago.
Wow.
And he said he saw me after the game and my eyes looked like two olives in a martini glass.
Wow.
Wow. And
floating?
And I couldn't remember how the Jets won until I watched the news at 11 o'clock.
Wow.
Now, I was very fortunate because the realization that I had a problem happened that night, because all of a sudden it's like, oh, that's how they did it. And I woke up at 3 a.m. saying, I think I have a problem with alcohol. So I called this guy who had stopped drinking earlier, and he took me to my first AA meeting. So it was really as simple as that. I mean, I know plenty of people that have had lots of trouble, and you know, the signs are go here, go here. They're like, no, I'm not going there.
Yeah.
But for me, it was just as simple as, you know, go to a meeting. And that was 38 years ago.
Wow. And so you were 12 at the time.
Yes.
You were young, right? I mean, you were a young guy at that time.
I was 30, 32.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So
because I'm old now.
Yeah, right. But you had been drinking pretty heavy. So you'd been drinking for a while.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I worked on Wall Street, and you would hit the bars as soon as you finished work. Really classy places like McCann's or McHale's, you know. And then hopefully you got on the right subway and headed home. And most times that happened. For me, there were times where it didn't happen right.
Wow.
But I didn't know that there was a problem at the time until this one football game.
So was that, how did you know this guy? I mean, he had seen you and
he had been somebody involved in our high school. And so I knew him from those days. And he had stopped drinking. And so that's how it all came about.
Okay. Okay. So he was at the game too with your group.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
The
only non-drinker there. And everybody's like, look at that guy. That guy nuts. He hasn't drunk.
Yes.
Drinking in 5 years.
Yes. What's exactly.
Yeah. You're here. Sure. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So was it a struggle to beat? Was it a struggle at first? I mean, to stop drinking. I mean, you had this realization. You're like, okay, this isn't good for me. That you know, in the middle of the night. But was it a struggle to, you know, kind of go to AA? I mean, did it catch you right away?
It was a struggle. Yes, it got me right away. But I mean, I thought I was going in with a bunch of old homeless guys, and my life was over.
Right. Okay.
And instead, I found that most of the people that were there were happy, joyful, able to laugh, able to talk about their experiences, even the bad ones, mm-hmm. and find joy in it.
Wow. Okay. So you didn't have any run-ins with the police or any, you know, kind of, well, you did say you got on some subways. You didn't know where you were, you know? So you, I guess you had some blackout type times.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. I lived in Boston when I was in college and lived off of the Green Line. And one okay. night went on the Orange Line and
okay.
you go all the way out to Jamaica Plains and wow. find out that it was the last train and there's no train going the other way.
Oh boy. Okay.
Taxi.
yeah. Yeah. That's going to be expensive. Right. So, okay. Okay. So you, and did you have relapses? I mean, was it something like, you know, once you started going and you realized this was a good group of supporting people, you were able to stay with it.
Yes. And there's been plenty of people I know that have had times where they've gone back out. Certainly I've had opportunities where that would be the case right. or experiences, bad things that happened that would say, you know, pick up a drink, you'll be a lot better off. But fortunately for me, I stayed in AA. And mainly that's if you've got good support from the very beginning, they talk about the 12 steps. They talk about having a sponsor. They talk about being involved in the group, giving away what you have learned to other people. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, that helps keep you on the program.
Okay. Okay. So was it your mentor, this guy who introduced you, or did you get somebody else?
He ended up being my sponsor for 20 years.
Wow. Okay. Okay. Cool. Well, that's cool. I mean, it's, imagine, you're at this place now where you started with going probably every day and all that. And is it still something that you find rewarding to go often or every day?
Yeah, I go probably, 3 or 4 times a week.
Okay.
And, I have found, my second sponsor ended up being a guy that believed in a lot of cliche type of sayings that made a lot of sense. So, for instance, okay. he would say 7 days without a meeting makes 1 week.
yeah. Okay. Yeah. So.
And it was the kind of things like that where you just get in touch with people that are also strong in their sobriety and right. you stay with them.
Okay, cool. Have you mentored people?
Oh yeah, quite a few.
Yeah,
and some are still around.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. So you've had some success, I'd say. Do you, what's that like? I mean, you think in the movies, it's like a call in the middle of the night or, you know, or you have to like go down to the local bar and pull the person out. I mean, but that's the movie. So what is it like in truth? What's that like to mentor somebody?
That's a pretty truthful way of looking at it. You know, we've had people that were in our group, one of which that I'm thinking of that, showed up at a meeting. She drove drunk to get there, you know, wow. and so all of a sudden you say, first of all, let's get you home. Mm-hmm. Let's not do it alone. You know, have some so that you're not in any way having a problem. And so you talk among the people that are there and say, well, what do you think? And it's like, well, I can drive her car if you take her in. Yours and that kind yeah. of thing. You work it all out and then you go ahead and process it.
Wow.
I've also been with a sponsee of mine that knew somebody that was in the hospital that had a lot of kidney and liver issues that were all drinking related. And he asked me to come with him to simply say there's a better way. Right. And sure enough, this guy is still in the program a bunch of years later. So that's all good. Some of my best friends are people that I met in sobriety and continue to be there. Some of my best golfers are sober.
Maybe that's why I haven't played golf. I don't drink enough.
but I can tell you, there was a time where you kind of take it for granted that it's easy. You stop going to as many meetings. You don't talk to as many people. And at that point, that was just about the time I was about to get divorced. Mm. And I realized that I needed to go to meetings every day for a while, talk about it in the meetings so that I was no longer just on my on something I was inside.
Yeah.
Get a new sponsor that I would talk to a lot more often because I kind of lost track, and then continue to sponsor people wherever possible. So it worked. And in fact, a very good friend of mine who got sober around the same time I did just recently went through that same thing, and he had called me up early on, and we talked about it, and he did the same things. He went to a lot of meetings, and he talked to a lot of people, and he's made it through to the other side. And that's the thing, is that I know people that have been through cancer, people that have been through divorce, people that have been through death. And if you pick it up from calling other people, going to a lot of meetings, you kind of get back in the swing of things rather than being morose.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've also heard so I'm going to have you defend AA. I've heard some people say, oh, you know, AA isn't effective, or AA isn't, you know, it isn't really a good program or whatever, you know, some things. But I guess, you know, what you're feeling is probably, tell me what you, you know, how you defend it in the light of other things. You know, there's people who have kind of, you know, looked down on it or dismiss it. And what do you think?
I think that there are those that would think that way because they've had stories that, you know, would give them that reason to think that way. But it's not like I can get anybody sober. All I can do is if they have a desire, I can offer it to them. So it's really, you know, here you go if you want it. Mm-hmm. And if you don't want it, you know, I've stayed sober.
Right. Right. So you can show them, you know, from your experience as well. And this is that it works. Yeah. That makes sense. I mean, that makes sense. I mean, it makes sense that, you know, the strength of the community, that it, as much as the steps, I mean, I think the steps, as I understand them, I don't have them all memorized, but, you know, there is a sense of opening up and becoming self-reflective. And I think that there is a lot of power in that. I think that there's a lot of power in kind of admitting weakness and seeking out a community, seeking out God, seeking out others to help through something that's not in your control, that and to be able to help see that. I think that that's so I think that those, yeah, my feeling is that, yeah, it is very helpful. I think, you know, the other thing I'm reminded of, kind of recent things, is people get annoyed with, in particular, with the step where you have to go to everybody and tell them, you know, oh, I'm sorry for everything I've done, you know, these things, specific things that I've done, is, and that's got to be awkward. I mean, you know, I mean, these days it's more like people don't want to hear, you know, oh, you hurt me, I don't want to hear this. But it's also going to be hard on you know, that the person's, you know, the addict, the drunk, you know, the alcoholic.
Yeah, I'll give you a perfect example. My dad and I had a really tough relationship for a long period of time. He would call me the black sheep of the family.
So was he Irish as well? Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I was 13 and the only one that came over.
Yeah, yeah. I have one of those too. Gee, it's a surprisingly reminiscent conversation. So yeah. So you had this struggle with dad.
Yes, and so in making amends to him in what they call the ninth step, it gave me an opportunity to be closer to him. It doesn't have to be, gee, you're a great guy. It's just I'm closer to you because you're my father.
Right.
And when it was his time to pass, I was holding his hand while he left. And not everybody gets a chance to do that. Mm-hmm. And had I not had cleared the waves beforehand, it wouldn't have been possible.
Yeah.
And one other thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm so sorry. I can't tell you how important finding a God in through the program is. And it's not where that anybody's saying, you know, this is the God and you have to follow it. It could be anything that is your God, you know, with a higher power, and how important that is to embrace while this is all going on, because this is what's going to get you through.
Mm. Mm. Can you say a little more or an example of what you think that was for you?
Sure. I can remember I had just gotten my apartment in the midst of my divorce, and there was all sorts of things that go on with lawyers and financial stuff and all the rest. And I could remember coming back to the apartment. I was very fortunate. I had a client that was moving out of his Fifth Avenue apartment and gave me a lot of furniture and stuff. Mm-hmm. So when I got into my this place, before I even turned on the lights, I found a sense of peace because I was no longer having the arrows in my back.
Yeah.
And in having that, it's just a thank you, you know, thank you for giving me this peace. And that just comes through how things have worked for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. When you're training to be a priest, or when I was training to be a priest, but every denomination has uses this program. They call it clinical pastoral education. It happens during the summer after your first year of seminary. And I went to a hospital to do mine in Vermont. It was the only, I think it's certainly, or one of the few or only level one trauma hospital in Vermont. And which means they take all sorts of, you know, all the bad, the car wrecks, the worst of the trauma. And I would come across working with people who were, you know, struggling with different addictions. And I had this one patient I actually met her on the first day, and she was a similar age as mine. She was a contemporary, and she was a mom, was on the PTA or the PTO. She worked on, she volunteered in the library at the kids' school, and she was, you know, kind of by all accounts, kind of this, you know, had it life put together and everything, you know, kind of everything going. She had these kids in grade school, and yet she was in the ER when I met her, you know, in a small room. And I came in, I distinctly remember, you know, kind of how jaundiced she was, how yellow the whites of her eyes were, how yellow her skin had become, this kind of orangey hue to it. And I remember the nurses telling me, oh, well, this person has, one, they said, well, she's an alcoholic. And two, the nurse would say, said that she had end stage liver disease, it was end stage liver disease. And, you know, I go in and I talk to her, and I was just amazed that here I am talking to somebody who's 40, they're late 30s to 40, similar age as me. And she's, you know, just kind of bottomed out. And she, over the course of 10 weeks that I was there, she got a little bit better. She opened up. I mean, she was able to admit that she was an alcoholic, right? And, you know, kind of came public with it, you know, so that family and friends and her kids and kind of understood what was happening to her. And I remember another nurse, and, you know, nurses tell it like it is, I find, and kind of the sergeants of hospitals. And the nurse said to me, you know, sometimes somebody's bottom is too low for the body. In other words, she drank herself. She wound up dying probably 15 weeks after she was in. I was back in seminary at the time, but she her liver was just gone. You know, she wasn't able to recover from the organ wasn't able to support her and sustain her. And she had to be, you know, without any alcohol for a certain period of time before she could be considered for a liver donation. Right. Mm-hmm. And she didn't make that, but I guess what it's amazing is that, you know, we never know how alcohol is going to affect us and how much damage it can cause, you know. And here's somebody who was, you know, kind of drinking when no one else was around, you know, no one would know. And she drank herself to a place where it killed her. It was really, really remarkable.
It happens more than you could imagine. It really does. And the success rate for even AA is still, you know, in the 40% range. So that means you're going to have somebody that gets in, may even realize that it's a problem, but the pull to have another drink is there.
Yeah.
And that's stronger than the desire to stay stopped.
Mm. Wow. That's remarkable. Okay. Let's before we finish up, we got to turn to something a little bit more happier thoughts here. So,
sure.
So are you going to play golf in France, or is this going to be all,
no touring? There's no golf in France for me.
Okay. Are you going to drive in France?
Yes. No.
No, you're not.
No, okay. We're doing tours. You know, you get on the bus in the morning.
Bussed
around, and we're going to Ireland next year, and I will be driving, and I will be doing the tour.
Brave soul.
So we'll see how that goes.
Yes. That's Well, that's good. Yeah, well, I think, you know, once you're out in the countryside, I think the roads are pretty narrow in Ireland. So it doesn't really matter which side of the road you're on, because you're on the side of the, you know, you're on the road, and it's only yes. wide enough for one car. So, okay. And if you decide, okay, so you're going to go, you're going to Paris for a few days, and then you're going to take a trip out to Normandy. Anything in particular? Is there a, what's the tour like?
To tell you the truth, I'm not sure. Neither Kathy nor myself have, you know, parents that were in World War II. But from what I understand, it is so, it's something you cannot miss
to
see what they did and how they got through it. So,
right. I haven't been there yet, so I'm A, jealous, and B, we'll get there soon. Yeah, I haven't done much of France,
in there, uh-huh.
but I guess I don't have much excuse, since I'm over in Kent, which is just across the channel, and so I need to get myself over there at some point. But that so you'll do a tour of the beaches and all of that, and the museums and that kind of stuff.
Yep.
That's fun. And then you're going to go look at this artwork. Tell me more about that.
Sure. Giverny became very important for one particular artist who was what is the term when they just put dots on?
Impressionist.
Yeah. That's it.
Yeah.
And it's one thing to see the paintings.
Right.
It's another thing to see the place where these were done, so that you can see what they were drawing, and then putting the two of them together. So it should be
right. Good. Right. Yeah. So if you stand too close to those paintings, all you see are dots. And back far enough, you can get the whole picture. Yeah, I get
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
No, but that'd be even cool to see. To see the place where, if it resembles, right. But if the place to see, like, oh, okay, that's what they're doing. You can put the two together. So that'd be cool. So good.
I had a art class during high school, given by a priest, and we had to bring in a picture of a landscape, and I can't draw for the life of me. So I'm trying to do this. And he's like, no, Andrew. And he takes my brush and starts going, bump, 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 bump. And then you, bump, 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 bump. And before you know it, you have this incredible picture. So there's a real art to being able to do it that I just don't have.
Yeah. Straight lines are a challenge.
Yeah, yeah.
And I fall into that group. But yeah. So yes, forget about trying to make a smile out of a bunch of dots or
that's exactly
a hat.
It. Yes.
I had that. So well, good. Well, buddy, this has been great. I really appreciate you taking time.
How fast time goes by.
Yeah. Yeah.
So especially when you're on time.
Especially when you're on time.
Thank you both, gentlemen. I really appreciate your honesty and your beautiful conversation. It's always fun to peek into you wouldn't be at a bar, of course, but like a restaurant conversation that two gentlemen are having. Good luck to both of you on your weddings, upcoming weddings, and to your sons and their brides and your families. You are listening to episode 10 of Courage to Thrive, starring Reverend Bob Flanagan, our host. And today our guest is his longtime friend, Andrew Cregan. So we will see you all next week. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio, Incandescent TV, Spotify, iHeart, and Apple Podcasts. We will see you all soon. Have a beautiful summer.